topic on the table is free trade versus protectionism. Dr. Rittenour's talk yesterday was an excellent introduction to this and laid the groundwork for this, and I'll try to build upon that. There's a lot of arguments over the last 200 years for protection, and I can't address them all, and I don't even think the Austrians, certainly Mises and Rothbard, have not addressed many of them, but they've given us this framework for thinking about these arguments, and that's what I'm going to try to explain today. Even though they've ignored some of the actual arguments, they've made this, they've built this set of theories that we can use and apply to these arguments regarding free trade and protectionism. And this is, it's a very timely topic, especially over the last couple of years with the Trump proposals on tariffs. I read, articles almost daily attacking the Trump tariffs. It seems like most people are free traders these days. And it didn't seem to be the case under the previous two presidents. I'm not sure why this is the case. And there, and there's all of these hostile arguments, and I'm not saying we shouldn't be hostile to these tariff proposals. This cartoon kind of represents the type of arguments we see, where we're all scared of the tariffs, and it's going to destroy the farmers and other sectors of the economy. But the argument for free trade is slightly more complicated than the argument against intervention in general. So Mises and Rothbard and others have concluded that government intervention does economic harm. We could spend 45 minutes quoting them on this. In his great 1956 article on utility and welfare economics, Murray Rothbard concludes, no government interference with exchanges can ever increase social utility. And he spends a great paper explaining this. But this does not counter the arguments for protection. This just tells us that tariffs harm the world economy. It doesn't tell us whether or not tariffs harm the world economy and benefit the U.S. So we can't use these same arguments. So at least a couple of times lately, I've read people attacking the Trump tariffs, and they've said, look, free trade within the 50 states has led to prosperity within the 50 states, which I agree with. But that doesn't counter the arguments for tariffs. That doesn't tell us whether or not an Alabama tariff on Tennessee products is good for Alabama. I mean, even if it's bad for the United States, is it good for Alabama? That's the economic argument. And you might immediately say, well, it can't be good for Alabama. But the question on the table is, can the government implement policies that transfer wealth from one region to another region? And don't we all agree that if they have political jurisdiction over both regions, that they can do this? If they have political jurisdictions over the United States, can't the government transfer wealth from one area to another area? So they can use the tariff. Multiple articles recently have explained that a tariff on steel will transfer wealth away from people who buy products with steel on it, with steel in it, and to the domestic steel industry. And they can transfer wealth from one region of the country to another. So if we read Tom DiLorenzo's work and other Austrians on the tariffs in the 1800s, we understand that the tariffs exploited the southern states and benefited northeast business interests. So the government can transfer wealth from one region to another region via the tariff. So the question on the table is, can they do it if they only have political jurisdiction over one region? So if they only have political jurisdiction over the North, could they implement a tariff that exploited the South and benefited the North? And so we can't just immediately reject this, because we already agree that they can use the tariff to transfer wealth from one region to another region if they have political jurisdiction over both regions. All right, so the standard answer that we tell all of our principals of economics students is that the law of comparative advantage tells us that this can't be the case. The law of comparative advantage tells us you won't benefit yourself with protectionist policies. This is, I assume that all of us that teach this have told our students this. And this is something economists agree on. Although it's rather complicated, it's not a law like the law of demand. There's a lot going on with the law of comparative advantage, but it's something we generally agree on. Paul Krugman says, if there were an economist creed, it would surely contain the affirmations: I understand the principle of comparative advantage, and I advocate free trade. And with apologies to Tom Woods for approvingly quoting Paul Krugman. This is pre-2000 Paul Krugman, when he was writing stuff I think that we should be reading. And you probably know this. This argument goes back over two centuries. We usually credit many of the articles credit to David Ricardo's 1817 book with explaining this law of comparative advantage. Murray Rothbard points out that other people were saying it before Ricardo, but that's a trivial matter, I think. Mises thinks this is a very important issue. He calls it the law of comparative cost. After spending 145 pages laying out the categories of action, Mises, 20 pages later, early in human action, explains this law of comparative advantage. And I don't have time to fully explain this because it's actually rather complicated. Again, it's not like the law of demand. Gottfried Hobbler spends 20 pages at least just sorting through the issues here on the law of comparative advantage. But there are various versions of the law of comparative advantage. There's various neoclassical versions of it, and there's various other schools of thought. They don't all explain it quite the same way, but there is some commonalities. Basically, there's two ways to use a country's resources to acquire goods. You can either produce the goods domestically, in which case the cost is the opportunity cost of production, as Dr. Rittenauer clearly explained yesterday. And then the other way to use domestic resources to acquire goods is to produce the goods domestically, export the goods, and import other products, in which case the cost is the terms of trade. The terms of trade is how much you have to export to get a unit of the imported good. And then according to this explanation, with free trade, entrepreneurs will tend to specialize in exporting goods where we have a comparative advantage. And then we'll tend to import goods where the terms of trade are less than the domestic opportunity cost, in which case you're acquiring goods at a lower cost. So you're using your resources more efficiently because you're trading with other countries. And because you're using your resources more efficiently, you can now consume more goods. Your consumption is greater than any possible level of production that you could have without trade. So the initial argument is that trade is better than no trade. And then you can extend this argument to say, well, protection reduces the trade, so it reduces these gains from trade. So this is many, many free traders rely on this argument. But this does not answer all the questions. This does not counter all of the arguments for protection. Although it's a very strong argument, Mises emphasizes this, this argument. All right, let's consider some of the more common arguments. And these are the arguments that I think you can use the law of comparative advantage to refute. And the common arguments tend to be the ones we hear the most are the weakest arguments for protection. We tend not to hear the good arguments for protection. So people making the case for tariffs tend to say things that are easily refuted. And one of the basic arguments we keep hearing is that tariff will and other protectionist policies will create jobs, will increase employment. They'll say, look, if we protect the steel industry, look at all the jobs we've created in the steel industry. And it does create jobs in the steel industry. But the counter argument is that those jobs come from somewhere else. So within the law of comparative advantage, they're assuming that labor market's clear. They're assuming if you create jobs in one industry that you lose jobs in another industry. So if you create jobs in an industry where you don't have a comparative advantage, you're going to lose jobs in an industry where you do have a comparative advantage. And even Paul Krugman admits he'll buy into this. So in one of my articles, I think I call Krugman a cautious free trader, the pre-2000 Krugman. And he says, constant employment is a reasonable approximation. So he's willing to, he thinks this is a silly argument. Of course, there's some things Paul Krugman agrees with us on. He thinks this is a silly argument for protection. And then the other argument we hear a lot is also really an argument about labor markets, if we think about it. And that's that there's a series of arguments that say we need to protect ourselves from low-priced imports. So sometimes some people say this is the cheap foreign labor argument, that the idea is that if we're going to trade with countries that have low-priced labor, that our workers are going to need to accept low wages in order to be competitive with those workers overseas. So we need to protect ourselves. They're going to sell us low-priced products, and it'll harm our workers, and they'll have to, the only way we could compete is with lower wages. The similar argument, really it's the same argument, is that we need to protect ourselves from other countries dumping products on our economy, which basically means they're selling us products at prices that are lower than our government approves of. It's a very vague dumping. There's about 3,000 charges a year where the federal government charges foreigners with dumping products on our markets. It's just this vague low price. It just means they're selling us products at low prices. But of course, we can use the law of comparative advantage. Lower prices for imports means we have better terms of trade. It means we don't have to export as much. We get to import more, and we get to have more stuff. We get to have more goods and services because they sell us stuff at low prices. The best thing that could possibly happen would be if others just gave us free stuff, free cars and clothes and food. This would be, if aliens would just appear and shower us with cars and clothes and food, we wouldn't have to work very much or at all. This would be the best possible world, the best possible terms of trade. We could keep everything we produce, plus we get to keep everything they produce, right? This would be wonderful. So this, again, is not a very strong argument for tariffs. Another argument that historically people have thought has been a slightly better argument than these first two is this infant industries argument that you may well have heard of. It goes back, well over two centuries. The argument, at some level, they sort of, some versions of this argument agree with the law of comparative advantage. They say we get to reap the benefits of trade by having free trade, but we have to wait until the industries are mature. We need to protect the industries during their infancy period, and once they're big, strong, competitive industries, we can have free trade, and the law of comparative advantage kicks in at that point, and we can reap these gains from trade. There's a lot of things wrong, I think, with this argument, but I think Rothbard really points out the main thing. So the main issue is we don't want some industries to be born. Some industries over the life of the industry would be a waste of resources. We only want certain industries to be born and go through its infancy period and mature and be competitive. And we should expect private investors to fund the right industries. We should expect private investors to notice the industries that are profitable over their lifetime and to fund them during their infancy period, and then there'll be strong competitive industries. I mean, private investors all the time lose money for a while and then they make money later on. This is not a new thing. So Rothbard, cogently points this out. He says, in fact, if long-run prospects in the new industry are so promising, why does not private enterprise ever on the lookout for a profitable investment opportunity enter the new field? only because entrepreneurs realized that such investments would be uneconomic. It would waste capital, land, and labor that could otherwise be invested to satisfy more urgent desires of the consumers. So the only way this argument makes sense is if you think government officials can spot the right industries better than private investors. So if you think that, if you think private investors have animal spirits and are basically irrational, and there's some government officials that know which industries to protect, that's the only way you can start to counter Rothbard's argument here. All right, these are very easy arguments to contradict. In these arguments, we should note that I'm assuming that the capital for these industries, is coming from a domestic source. So they're reallocating capital, if they're funding the infant industry, away from another domestic industry. The capital is not coming from foreign investment. Sometimes these two arguments get confused, the infant industry's argument and the argument about foreign investment. So it's important to separate these two points. But these arguments are silly arguments. I'm going to go back to Krugman here. Krugman talks about these arguments, and he says, I'm convinced that many economists, when they try to argue in favor of free trade, make the mistake of overestimating both their opponents and their audience. It is remarkably easy to make fools of your opponents, catching them in elementary errors of logic and fact. This is playing dirty, and I advocate it strongly. So it's easy to crush these simplistic arguments for tariffs. All right. But this law of comparative advantage has a lot of underlying economic analyses to it about labor markets and entrepreneurial decision making, and it has a lot of premises to this argument. And if these premises are not correct, then we can't base our free trade arguments on this law. We can't always use the law of comparative advantage to counter pro-tariff arguments. This is similar to, say, non-Euclidean geometry. So once you say you object to Euclid's controversial postulate about parallel lines, then the rest of the Euclidean edifice kind of collapses, right? You can't rely on his proofs anymore. So it's a similar idea here for thinking about the case for free trade. So what are some of these premises? Well, one of the premises is that the tariff does not affect the terms of trade. So when we explain the damage of protection using the law of comparative advantage, we always assume that the protection, that we have the same terms of trade with and without the tariff. Or that's the general argument here, at least. But as early as the 1840s and maybe probably the 1820s, people were pointing out that might not be the case. And this is the basis of the optimal tariff argument. So if a tariff on steel lowers the world price of steel, then this will improve the U.S. terms of trade. And if the benefits of the improved terms of trade exceed any damage done by the tariff, then wouldn't it be better to have the tariff rather than not have the tariff? Wouldn't the net benefits of the tariff be positive? That's the basic argument in very brief form. And we can't, again, this the law of comparative advantage just assumes this away. It doesn't directly counter this argument. I'll give you a framework for countering these arguments after I talk about these premises. Another issue that goes back, I don't know, a century or so, as soon as they started talking about externalities, implicitly, when we talk about the law of comparative advantage, we're assuming that there's no positive externalities. So this literature has arisen in the neoclassical world saying, what if there are externalities? And generally, they're talking about research and development. They're talking about the benefits of having industries within our country that engage in research and development, and maybe that research and development helps other industries in the country. So briefly, the argument is, could the government target the right industries? Shouldn't the government impose tariffs on industries and protect industries that would allow them to locate here, and those industries would engage in research and development? That research and development would diffuse throughout the economy and help other industries, generating these positive externalities. And if the benefits of the externalities exceed any damage of the tariff, then the tariff has generated net benefits to our economy. In brief, that's the argument. And then there's a newer argument. It's not new, but it's newer. Within the law of comparative advantage, we're assuming that prices and costs are correlated. So you'll see time and time again, people explain the law of comparative advantage, and they'll say the cost in this industry is twice the cost in that industry, therefore the price in this industry will be twice the price in that industry. There will be a strict one-to-one correlation between costs and prices. So in the neoclassical world, we call this purely competitive markets. Markets are purely competitive. But what if they're not? Well, if they're not, then all sorts of things happen. There's just all sorts of arguments for tariffs. Paul Krugman won his Nobel Prize largely for his work in this area. Not that we approve of that, but so I'll give you one. This is a very complicated issue. I'll give you one example. Suppose there's a firm that it has a lot of market power, and it's going to make tremendous profits, and it's going to sell to people around the globe. So wouldn't it be best to have that firm located in our country? And that way, the firm's located in our country. They're not using many of our resources because their price is a lot higher than their costs, and they're generating all of this revenue by selling to people in Europe and Asia, and these rents from firms with this tremendous market power, these additional benefits to these rents may exceed the damage of a tariff. Again, wouldn't a tariff generate net benefits in such a situation? All right, these are all well-known arguments for protection. But I think the argument that we hear a lot from politicians is a different argument. So I'm going to focus on that argument in particular. So another very important explicit premise of the law of comparative advantage is that capital is immobile across political borders. So the idea is the factors of production are completely mobile within the country, but they tend to not cross political borders. So capital does not move from the US to China or from Europe to the US. It's a critical explicit premise in Ricardo. It's an explicit premise in Mises's work in this area. Mises multiple times says, Ricardo, here's one of his quotes. He says, Ricardo deals with a world whose conditions are determined by settlement in earlier days, a world in which capital goods and labor are bound to the soil by definite institutions. Here the law of comparative cost comes into operation. At times Mises has said, law of comparative advantage, and sometimes he says law of comparative cost. And then 10 pages earlier in Human Action, he basically said the same thing in his 1943 article, Autarky and Its Consequences. He makes a similar statement. He drives this point home. He's writing this in the 1940s. He's saying in the 1940s, capital is essentially immobile. There's not a lot of foreign investment. So he's saying we can rely on the law of comparative advantage here. And we'll have further proof here. We'll go to the master. Joe Salerno says, the Ricardian theory of comparative advantage does only apply under the assumption of absolutely rigid factor immobility between countries. This is not a controversial statement. All right, so if we're going to give Presidents Trump and Obama and Bush any credit for their arguments for tariffs, we might say this is their argument if we read between the lines a bit. Isn't this really what they're talking about? Sometimes it's sort of explicit. So they're saying tariffs will tend to increase net capital flows into the U.S. I think this is what they're saying. They tend to ignore any negative effects of tariffs and only look at the positive effects of the capital flows. But nonetheless, I think this is, if we want to give them a sympathetic reading, this might be their argument. All right, this is not a new argument. Gottfried Hobbler, in his international trade book that you could read at Mises.org, it's available online. The English version came out in 1935. It was translated in 1935. And he cites multiple authors making this case for tariffs before 1930. This is an old argument. The first step in the argument is, can the tariff increase net capital flows? So net capital flows are capital inflows minus capital outflows. So more capital, net capital flows means there's either less capital flowing out of the country, or there's more capital flowing into the country. And Obler goes through historical examples, and he says, the facts on which this argument is based are not open to question. Thousands of cases bear witness that the imposition or raising of tariffs may lead to an import of capital. It's Hobbler, he's in favor of free trade. He's just saying, yes, a tariff may increase investment in the protected industry. He's not talking about the economy overall. He's saying, if we protect the steel industry, there'll tend to be foreign investment in the steel industry. And then the second step in the argument is that these capital flows benefit us economically. So in the government's measure of capital flows, they include things like China loaning money to the US government. That's not the type of capital flows Mises is talking about. He's talking about foreign investment in the private sector in our economy. And he spends several pages in A Human Action explaining the historical situation here. And then he says, it was European capital that accelerated considerably the marvelous economic evolution of the United States and the British Dominions. Thanks to foreign capital, the countries of Latin America and Asia are today equipped with facilities for production and transportation, which they would have had to forgo for a very long time if they had not received this aid. Real wages and farm yields are higher today in those areas than they would have been in the absence of foreign capital. We probably all agree this is more capital is better. More private capital is better for our economy. And then Mises has a wonderful short article called The Plight of Underdeveloped Nations, and he says much the same thing. He says they're underdeveloped because they have been slow in developing those ideological and institutional conditions, which are the indispensable prerequisite of large-scale capital accumulation. And he says, what should these nations do to eradicate penury? They must resort to laissez-faire. They must remove all obstacles, fettering the spirit of enterprise and stunting domestic capital accumulation and the inflow of capital abroad. So these underdeveloped nations don't save enough money to develop their own capital. So he's making the case here that they should have institutions that attract foreign capital. He's not making the case for tariffs. He's making the case that they should have other institutions that attract capital flows into their countries. So it's a very straightforward argument once we see these two steps. So we've seen that a tariff could possibly lead to net capital flows into the country, and that there would be benefits if that occurred. So the point here, and the reason you can't use the law of comparative advantage here, is that in the law of comparative advantage, if you produce more of one product, the opportunity cost falls on your country, right, on your economy. But here, the opportunity cost is borne by the other, to some degree, by the other country. So if we protect our car industry and Toyota builds cars here, the opportunity cost is that they didn't build cars somewhere else. So this is why they argue maybe tariffs are good due to these the possibility of attracting foreign capital. And then the conclusion would be, if there were benefits of this increased capital stock, or there are benefits, the tariff generates increased capital accumulation with the resulting benefits. If the resulting benefits outweigh any inefficiencies due to the tariff leading to an inefficient allocation of resources, then there are net benefits to the tariff. This is the pro-tariff argument that I think is on the table here. All right, so how should we respond to this argument? There's a lot of responses, I think, but and I can't even cover them all. There are free traders out there that are basically free trade in every situation. They say they've looked at the data, and it tells us that in all of these cases, historically, free trade has been, the tariffs have done harm, right? Even if there's capital flows or optimal tariffs or in all these arguments, there are pro-free trade economists that say that these are theoretically valid arguments, but empirically they're wrong. But we can't empirically test proposed, what are we going to do with proposed tariffs? I mean, we can't test Trump's proposed steel tariff and aluminum tariffs. Well, all we can do is say what happened in the 1800s, right? So there was no Trump tariffs in the 1800s. So that we can't really refute the upcoming tariffs using this type of argument, I think. I think the Misesians have a theoretical response to these arguments. All right, let me talk about some of the free trade arguments, and then I'll get to what I think is the heart of the matter. So when we see these arguments for tariffs, most of these arguments are in the neoclassical world. They assume away any public choice problems. They assume the government's going to attempt to enact policies that help out society, and they're not. They assume government officials are not trying to acquire and hold on to political power. Even Paul Krugman admits this is nonsense. He says governments, he's talking about the tariff in particular. He says governments do not necessarily act in the national interest, especially when making detailed microeconomic interventions. Instead, they are influenced by interest group pressures. Another argument for free trade is that in the arguments I just laid out, I was sort of assuming away any possibility that foreign governments retaliated in any manner. But of course, they're going to generally retaliate to US tariffs. In the neoclassical world, when they build the pro-tariff models, they usually use the phrase that foreign governments are passive, which means that foreign governments just do not react at all to US policies. Right? But the arguments kind of crumble once the foreign government starts to try and to attract capital flows or improve their terms of trade. Another argument that I don't think gets emphasis, another argument for free trade regarding capital flows is that there's a lot of things that attract capital. The tariff is not, I don't even think the tariff is the main thing. The main thing that attracts capital is just the general business conditions and the institutional structure within that country. Does the institutional structure allow investors to reap their profits? And this is not a discussion-ending argument, but it seems to me that we could make the case that governments that have free trade policies would also tend to have other policies that would attract capital. They would tend to be less interventionist overall, and these are the types of economies I would expect foreign investors to want to invest in. But we see the general condition of the economy is a critical issue. When after the 2008-2009 economic collapse, foreign investment collapsed in our economy. Foreign investors did not want to, the trade deficit fell 50% because foreign investment collapsed in our economy, because general business conditions have more to do with the foreign investment than a tariff. But I don't think this is the overwhelming case for free trade. I think there's a strong argument for free trade that refutes all of these more sophisticated arguments for protection. And the problem here with implementing a tariff, say to attract foreign capital, is that the effects of the tariff, especially a tariff on like steel or aluminum, the effects would just ripple throughout the economy and affect so many decisions. Ben Powell has a recent article saying that the proposed Trump tariff on steel would affect millions of decisions. I think that's correct. Right? It's just going to affect every entrepreneur who's using steel in making their product. So these effects are just assumed away when people say that we need to try to attract foreign capital via the use of the tariff. They just forget about the general equilibrium effects here. So if you're going to, let's assume that the government could impose a tariff that attracted more capital into the country. If you're going to attract more capital, that means you're going to have a larger trade deficit. There's a strict correlation between the size of the trade deficit and the amount of net capital flows. If there's more net capital flows, there's a bigger trade deficit. So if you're going to have a bigger trade deficit, that either means that you're importing more or you're exporting less. So suppose you're importing more. So you protect industry A, so that means you import more at industry B. That means foreigners are producing more of this industry B product. This is a profit opportunity for U.S. investors to invest overseas. So this would tend to lead to capital flowing out of the country in this other industry. The other option is that if we increase net capital flows, we have a larger trade deficit, maybe that leads to fewer U.S. exports. So if the U.S. industries are not going to export product C, that means other countries are going to produce more of product C because we're not producing it. So that's a profit opportunity for U.S. investors to invest in product C overseas. So these capital inflows into the protected industry leads to capital outflows in other industries. It also leads to more capital inflows. And some industries expand, some industries contract. It's a very complicated set of issues here. The tariff affects a lot more than the protected industry. Another issue here is that if we protect the domestic industry, not only will foreign investors tend to invest in industry A, but domestic investors will also. So we will reallocate capital away from some other industry into industry A. We'll reallocate it from industry D to industry A. That means we're going to produce less of this industry. Oh, I've confused my letters here, haven't I? I apologize. So if we're going to produce, if domestic investors are going to invest in the protected industry, they're going to invest less in some other industry. Whatever industry that is, foreigners are going to pick up the slack and produce that more of that product. So again, this is a profit opportunity for U.S. investors to invest overseas in that industry. Another example of why attracting capital in one industry leads to capital outflows in other industries. Gottfried Haubeler sort of discusses this in 1935 about all these complications. And he starts the discussion by saying, even if you attract capital in one industry, you'll never increase capital overall. And then 7 pages later, he says, well, it's unlikely. So he kind of backs up and says, well, maybe you will, but it's unlikely. And so he could like imagine a world where overall capital flows increased. But there's a lot of other complications, a lot of other general equilibrium complications. So in addition to these industries expanding and contracting due to the tariff, as the tariff effects ripple throughout the economy, as industries get larger and smaller, their capital intensities tend to change. So they don't stick with the same combination of capital and labor. So this is an additional complication that the government has to understand if they want to implement these policies. And another thing that happens is that the short-run effects are different than the long-run effects. So if the government wants to try to implement this wonderful tariff to increase the amount of investment in our economy, in the short run, the elasticities tend to be less than in the long run. The government's going to have to take this into effect, into consideration. They're going to have to try to guess what are the long run price elasticities in all of these industries. This is just an impossible situation, I think. So I think the case for free trade is analogous to this impossibility of socialism. You've heard Dr. Salerno explain this case. I don't have to drone on about it. But Mises, in talking about the impossibility of socialism, says, the theory of economic calculation shows that in the socialist community, economic calculation would be impossible, as you heard earlier today. And he goes further and says, calculation is possible only when prices for all kinds of goods and services are established in the market and furnish a basis of reckoning. Where there is no market, there is no price system. And where there is no price system, there can be no economic calculation. So it's possible to implement a society, an economy with private property, with the market prices for resources, and that would lead to economic calculation. It's impossible for the government with socialist policies to figure out to perform this economic calculation. Isn't this a similar argument to trade? There's imposing these tariffs or other protectionist policies to attract capital or for other reasons, it's just impossible for the government to predict what's going to happen. Right? So similarly, it's not the calculation argument, but I think it's a similar argument. As Peter Klein explained, the market is a process. Entrepreneurs face risk and uncertainty. An entrepreneur is not even certain about what's the outcome of his decision. And no entrepreneur knows what the outcome is throughout the economy. It's just an impossible set of things to understand. And yet, to implement these optimal trade policies, the optimal tariff policies, to implement protectionist policies that benefit the economy, generates an impossible calculation for the government that simply can't understand all of the effects of a tariff. They can't, even if you could consider a world where the tariff attracted capital and the benefits of the capital exceeded any damage, it's impossible for the government to implement that policy. Right? Free trade is an implementable policy, just like private property and free market prices is an implementable policy. But welfare-enhancing protectionist policy is not. Right? It's impossible, I think, in the same sense. All right, that's my case, my hopefully Misesian case for free trade. Thank you.